I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
All right, welcome to the Talk is Jericho. It's the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll. And Scotty Too Hotty makes his Talk is Jericho debut today. He's talking about all his time at WWE, including his most recent run as a coach at the Performance Center and a live show producer for NXT. Scotty spent 4 years working at the Performance Center and talks about the talent that came through and what he loved about coaching. He also explains what prompted him to quit, and he shares his thoughts on all the changes at NXT over the last year. Scotty talks about his early days at WWE as a performer. He remembers his tryout, what finally landed him a WWE contract, and how he got to be teamed up with Too Sexy Brian Christopher. He talks about the evolution of their tag team, Too Much to Too Cool, and how Rikishi came to be their third. He's got stories about what inspired The Worm, the dancing, who they had the most fun with in the ring. He recalls some of his favorite matches and moments, explains why Too Cool eventually split up, and shares the details behind his original release from WWE. Scotty also recently returned to wrestling. He's back in the ring, performing in the indies, and loving every minute of it. And now that he's back on the scene, he is a busy man. Think of all these dates in February, the 3rd and 4th in San Antonio, the 5th in Jackson, Tennessee, the 10th Orlando, the 11th Butler, New Jersey, then he's hitting Alabama on the 12th, Taunton, Massachusetts on the 25th. Lots of stuff going on. Make sure you go to @thescottytoohotty. That's S-C-O-T-T-Y, H-O-T-T-Y, thescottytoohotty on Twitter, and get all the information on where he's going to be. All right. Information where I'm going to be next year, February 2nd to the 6th. That's when Chris Jericho's Rockin' Wrestling Rager at Sea, the Four Leaf Clover, takes place. Go to chrisjerichocruise.com to sign up for the mailing list and find out all the information as you can book your cabin, as we got a whole lot more time now and our lineup is basically staying the same. And we're going to our very own private island as we set sail from Miami and head to the Great Stirrup Cay in the Bahamas. Like I said, a stop at your very own private island. It's going to be the vacation of a lifetime, chrisjerichocruise.com. In the meantime, Fozzy's spring leg of the Save the World Tour in the United States is rolling on as scheduled. We're hitting the road again on March 31st with our new drummer, Grant Brooks, in tow. We're crossing the country. We're going everywhere, East Coast, West Coast. We're going to the Whiskey A Go-Go. We're going to the Irving Plaza. We're going everywhere. So go to FozzyRock.com for all ticket information and VIP information. We play a private concert just for you if you're a VIP. Get all that information at FozzyRock.com. Go do it now. Rock with us in March, but hang with us right here, right now, today. Scotty Too Hotty on Talk is Jericho. Here's something funny. We're just going to jump right into this right now. So it's always cool to start with something fun. So Scotty Too Hotty is here. And the last time we saw each other was at Paul McCartney in Orlando. So he texts me and says, are you at Paul McCartney? I think that he DMs me on Twitter. I think that I'm DMing him back. And I say, yeah. I said, instead of DMing me, just text me at this number. So I put my phone back in my pocket and it starts from like boop, boop, like buzzing. Bzz, bzz, bzz. I'm like, what the hell's going on? I've got 100 texts on my phone, 101, 102. And then you text me and go, hey, man, I think you posted your number on social media.
I was just telling a story to somebody the other day. That was funny.
Yeah. So I just said, well, I'm just going to no sell it and just hopefully they'll just leave me alone. And after about a week they did, but once in a while I changed numbers now, but for a while, once in a while, I would still get a, is this Chris Jericho? And I was like, Scotty, too hot.
That's all my fault.
But it's good to talk to you, man. And you reached out to me. It's a new leaf for you, a new time in your life. And it's probably pretty exciting because now, and we'll talk about everything, but right now, after years of being in the performance center, which we'll talk about, you're now kind of back on the streets, going back into the ring again.
Yeah, I am. And you know what the coolest part about it is it was my choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a goal from, you know, it goes back to 2007 when I was released as a wrestler, you know. In 2006, my contract was up and they asked me to sign a new three-year deal. And I was on the fence for like a month. You know, I wasn't happy. I was doing dark matches. I was doing matches with, you know, the new flavor of the week and not really having fun. Right. So,
yeah.
But I said, hell with it. And I ended up signing that three-year deal. Well, a year into that three-year deal, I was released.
Okay.
And I told myself never again would I do that, you know, and that's kind of where I was at. This time around, you know, I was just not having fun and it was, I knew it was time to move on. And I told myself when I came back, that was one of my goals, was to walk away on my own this time.
So you could kind of see the writing on the wall when they were kind of deciding the first time to let you go if you weren't being used. Was that what's kind of going on in the performance center too? Or was it just not fun for you there anymore?
A little of both. You know, I saw the writing on the wall. And as everybody knows, you know, NXT has changed a lot over the last, you know, 6 months to a year. And for that first 4 years or so, it was the dream job. It was awesome. You know, NXT was like the hottest thing in wrestling, you know, the hottest brand in wrestling for a long time. Even though it wasn't the biggest, it was still, you know, we would go to a WrestleMania weekend or a SummerSlam weekend and steal the show, you know.
Because
and
it the was cool just, factor.
It was the cool factor, right?
Yeah.
And then just over the last 6 months to a year, a lot of changes happening. And I understand, you know, I understand where they're coming from. But for me personally, it was just that, you know, like you said, the writing was on the wall and it was time to go. And dude, looking around, you know, I'm seeing, you know, what you guys are doing over there at AEW. And I'm seeing, you know, you having fun and Matt Hardy having fun. You know, I see Adam Cole walk out there with a different guy and just like I texted him like, dude, you look like you're having so much fun over there. Yeah. And then, you know, do you take outside of AEW, even like, you know, on the independent scene right now, Matt Cardona is out there killing it every weekend. Mm-hmm. And he says the same thing. He's having a blast. And I'm going, dude, I'm the same age as Jericho and Matt and Ed, you know, and Edge, you know, I know I can still do this. I'm still in decent shape. And if I'm going to do this, now is the time.
So that's pretty cool because like you mentioned, it's been the last 4 or 5 years with NXT. So now to go back into the ring, were you starting to feel that itch even before AEW? Did you think that you went into the training zone maybe a little bit too early or?
Well, I was done because I was first offered a job at FCW when Bill DeMott was over there. And, you know, there were rumors of them moving to Orlando and becoming something different. But I was going through fire school at the time, and I just kind of decided to move out and move into the firefighting EMT thing, you know, which was, looking back, was a crazy idea. But I just wanted to do something different, you know. And I said no then. And then when it happened in Orlando, in my own backyard, Matt Bloom is the head coach now, who's been one of my best friends for, you know, 25 years. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed to all fall into place. And it was kind of a no-brainer. And then as soon as I did it, and I didn't know if I could be a coach. I was a backyard guy before there was a word for backyard wrestling.
Oh, okay.
You know, so I never went to a proper wrestling school. Was never properly trained. I learned on 18 mattresses in my mom's garage. And, you know, I'm sure you remember that there was a tape out at the time called Secrets of Pro Wrestling, you know, and that's kind of how we learned, you know, a lot of our stuff, you know, and we met a guy who got us booked on some local shows and it just snowballed from there.
So you said you weren't sure how to be a trainer because of that.
Right, because I was never trained. So I'm going to, you know, especially when you have guys like Norman Smiley and Robbie Brookside in there who could, you know, wrestle a paper bag, you know, and with their technical part of it is so good at what they do, where I just kind of, you know, bullshitted my way through. You know, I would always do the tie up, you know, take the arm, the guy take it back. I do a front roll, back roll, handspring, and I'm like, man, that guy knows what he's doing.
I just do it again. Yeah. But you know, the difference is though, Scotty, is that you have the experience. I mean, Norman had a little bit of it, but as far as being on the main stage for many years, that experience is much more valuable than knowing how to do, you know, a freaking hammer lock into a twist lock into a, you know, arm lock or whatever that would be.
Yeah. And I found that out over time, you know, my confidence built over the 5 to 6 years that I was there, and I fell in love with the job, man, and working with these kids and seeing them grow, you know, from the ground up. And all of a sudden, you know, they're at WrestleMania, you know? And so that's somebody like somebody like a Lacey Evans, I taught her how to throw a punch, and then, you know, and then I ended up naming the punch, you know, the women's right. And like, and then you see that being used, you know, I'm in the gym doing cardio on a Monday night or whatever, and I see her on the TV in the gym, and that's like, this is a pretty cool payoff to all that, you know? So I fell in love with the job, and that was one of the hard parts of leaving and asking for the release, I think, was to just kind of walk away from all those people, you know, because I love the coaches. I love the talent that I worked with, and they become kind of like your kids. You know, I always say like Renee Gonzalez and Rhea Ripley both became like I call them my wrestling daughters. You know, I saw them grow and mature and, you know, dude, go on and be successful, you know?
So what was your role in the PC? Like, where did you go? What level were you at coach wise and all that sort of thing? Kind of explain that.
So pretty much everybody that walks in the door goes to either Norman Smiley or Robbie Brookside right away. And they teach them the foundation and the basics, which I can't teach at all. Right. And then from there, they kind of spread out between Steve Carino, myself, Chris Guy. And then it kind of goes up the ladder to Terry Taylor, Shawn Michaels. And I was more of the storytelling, showbiz, psychology part of it, you know, which I love, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, that was it, man.
So they would kind of have, because there's so many students in the class, they would go through the beginnings with Robbie and Norman. And then as they kind of improve, would they kind of leave that ring and go into your ring sort of a thing? Is that how it works, ring by ring?
Yeah, about every 1 or 2 months, classes would change. You know, and some people would advance, some people would stay in the class they were in, depending how they were doing, you know.
Yeah.
Now, dude, it's just a kind of fast track. They want everybody on television soon, quick, you know. So we'll see, man. I don't know how it does, but it's all kind of a new system now over the last 6 months to a year.
So you mentioned Rhea Ripley and you mentioned Raquel Gonzalez. So what were you teaching them that you really felt like, you said they felt like your kids? Like, why is that, those two and not everybody?
I think it's just all about the relationship you create with them. Mm-hmm. And I had specifically asked for those two. They just needed the confidence. You know how it is. Once you see the confidence changes everything.
Yes.
And I had never had any women in my class up till that point, and really never again after, which is kind of weird. But I had them working with guys. I had them in there with Ricochet. I had them in there with Marcel, Fabian. Lilia Rush was in my class at the time. And they just needed to learn to kind of lay their stuff in and not hold back, which they would do with some of the smaller girls, you know, and they just needed, you know, both those guys, Marcel, Fabian, all those guys I mentioned can go, you know, and they just needed somebody to lead them and increase their confidence. And that's what happened.
So what about from the guys' side? Were there some of those dudes that you felt affinity with?
Yeah, Street Profits for sure. Mm-hmm. I think you can kind of see the guys I would gravitate, more of the entertainment guys.
I see. Wow, okay.
Yeah,
I
got you. Otis, you know.
What a great guy.
Yeah, awesome, dude. Awesome. You know, those guys. And just kind of, you know, you can get away, and, you know, as you know, like you can get away with, as we call it, like the ha-ha and the character stuff up to a point. But then, like for me personally, I could come out and be jumping around, you know, do my thing. They want to see the worm, you know, but at some point you have to get serious in there. It can't be all comedy all the way through, you know, and you kind of have to, sometimes people want to do too much, and there's nothing worse than bad comedy in wrestling.
Yeah, right? That's right. Good point. So what were some of the people that came through that A, right away you knew were going to be big stars because they had it? And then we'll answer that question first. Then I have a sister question to that.
Definitely Otis. I mean, the guy was like, what's his name? Chris Farley. He's like Chris Farley, Belushi, like reincarnated. The dude was just funny. Like he didn't even have to open his mouth. You just look at him and just the way he's, you know, him. Same thing. Street Profits, although I can remember, we would have to do weekly reports, just kind of what a rundown of what we did in our class. And I can literally remember with Ford, who's a wild man now and just crazy, you know, his personality wise, just crazy. I can remember writing in my reports, I need to get him to come out of his shell.
Oh,
you know, and like, right. He wouldn't say two words in class, you know, but eventually he came out of that show and they've gone on to do really well. Elias was a guy I worked with early on. You know, we did a Japan, Australia tour back in 2016, and I worked with him a lot on trying to figure out how to make that whole character work. Yeah, there's a few of the guys, you know.
Was it kind of frustrating at times because there was a little bit of a pattern where you guys would build up certain talents in NXT and then they would go to the main roster and not get really much of a chance to shine at all? Happened quite often.
Yeah, it's frustrating, right? And, and I can't even explain it. You know, a guy like Bobby Roode, I go, man, they're going to love him up there. He looks like a man, right? Like,
I can't wait to see him
go up there. And a guy like Roode, dude, he's a guy who was, you know, he had worked for years and years just to get there. You know, Eric Young's another one. You know, they go up, they were like, oh, I can't wait to see this Sanity entrance on a big stage. You know, it's going to be so cool. They go up and nothing. And it happened over and over and over, right? Like, nobody just, I don't want to say nobody, but they just didn't have that same feeling when they went up, you know, which is sad.
Is that something you guys discuss? I mean, obviously, especially when we can talk about this, when Triple H was really in charge, would he ever say anything about that? Or was he just kind of like knowing that's just how it is?
Not to me, but I mean, dude, he's got to feel it, right?
Sure.
Like I just, he felt like he had his, he was the man. I'll say it, like he was the man. And I would see him in rehearsal sometime, just like he would come out, what's his name? Priest. Damian Priest was debuting and was rehearsing his entrance. And I can remember him doing it over and over. And then Hunter said, can we move that light? Move your head a little bit this way. Every time you headbang, the light's going to shine through. And it's just like he would see that stuff. And Hunter's dude is, he's kind of like us. He's a Kiss fan. He's a rock and roll fan, right? Yeah. So it was like he kind of brought rock and roll into wrestling and made it cool again, you know? And it just felt like when they went up, they lost a little something. You know, some guys, Priest has done all right, though.
But yeah, he has. Yeah. So then other guys like Ricochet has not gotten the shots that he should have got. But that to me was a no-brainer.
Yep.
Good-looking guy, real-life superhero. And then what do? They try and promote him as a superhero.
Yep.
Talk is Jericho is brought.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
To you in part by Steven Singer Jewelers, the moment you've been waiting for is finally here. Steven Singer is announcing his brand new rose color for this Valentine's Day. Are you ready for what it is? Click your heels 3 times and say, I wish I knew what the new color is. Well, wish is granted. Steven Singer's brand new rose is Emerald City. Picture it, a real rose dipped and trimmed in 24-karat gold with sparkling deep green petals. This magical Emerald City rose will take her breath away this Valentine's Day as she opens that beautiful gift box to reveal a real rose encased in 24-karat gold, brilliantly set against a stunning deep green. Go to IHateStevenSinger.com today and get your Steven Singer Emerald City 24-karat gold dip rose. Get yours before they're gone, exclusively and only available at Steven Singer Jewelers. It's the number one gift this Valentine's Day. Steven's famous gold-dipped roses start at just $59, and all of them come with a lifetime guarantee and fast, free shipping. Real jewelers, real roses for your real love, all at IHateStevenSinger.com. jericho.com. Well, I want to get into to your career and Too Cool and all that stuff, but the last thing, you mentioned that it's changed over the last 6 months, and we can see that on the screen and kind of how it's went from kind of a rival with AEW to then just going completely in a left direction, all new guys, all different look. When did that start happening, and how did that change your mentality of what was going on? Because you mentioned that's one of the reasons why you wanted to go.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, it was when right around the rebranding, you know, and they just decided to go in a different direction. And you know, Hunter used to say we have this culture here that if we could bottle it, we could make millions off this culture. And it was more of the backstage culture that we are NXT thing was a real thing. That was a real pride, you know,
amongst the roster.
Yeah. I feel like that's been lost to a degree, which is sad, dude. It was the coolest environment that I'd ever been in my, you know, 30 years in wrestling. Like, there was just never that, you know. It was still a wrestling business, don't get me wrong, but there was a certain pride there that wasn't anywhere else. And it just started to change, dude. And they started to come in with, you know, rules. And one of the first weeks since COVID, they started to let us wear the NXT tracksuits to TV because we don't see anybody. You know, we come into the performance center for television. We don't have any fans waiting outside. For the longest time, there weren't any fans.
Nobody there, yeah.
And then in the building, it's all in-house people. So we were wearing NXT tracksuits. And then, you know, as soon as it started to change, you know, and Hunter went away and the other guys started to come in, and it was, okay, we got a business back to business cash now. And then, you know, then the next week it was, this is awesome. The next week was, Vince wants the coaches looking younger. So we need you guys to start dyeing your beards and cutting your hair. The coaches.
What?
So I literally lost sleep over it. And I'm like, you know, a couple of them went and they did it right away. And dude, I've had every kind of facial, just like you, every kind of facial hair dyed, dyed, right. You know, the chin strap, the goatee, the beard,
the Fu Manchu.
I've had everything, you know, spiked up hair, bald head. So it's not about that. It was like, dude, what are they just, they're making us jump through hoops like monkeys just to see if we'll do it. You know, so if you do that, what's next? Right. So that was just the beginning of.
I have a theory, and you don't have to comment on this. This is not that type of show, and you've listened before. I think, knowing Vince as well as I do, and you've been there for many years as well, I think that when AEW started beating NXT handily every week, that Vince used NXT as a scapegoat and blamed NXT because if I was running it, we would have killed them.
Yes.
It's obviously not working because of what Hunter's doing or what, you know, Regal's doing or what Scotty Too Hotty's doing. Clear them all out. I'm taking over and I'm going to show you what it's all. I really believe that happened because of the AEW.
No, I agree. Yeah, that's what it feels like, right? There's just not a lot of explanation to it and what happened. It pisses you off, right, as being a part of it, but it's also sad because it was almost like they killed it off, and they killed this awesome thing that we had off, you know, so we lost this thing, and it was almost like dealing with a death, dude, and it was just sad, you know. I think people, you know, in my statement when I left, I said, you know, I just wasn't having fun anymore, and I said something about the yellow and gold brand, and a lot of people took that and ran it with, I was just shitting on the show. And, you know, the show is what it is, and the new show will give a lot of young people opportunity, but there's a lot of people busting their ass to make that show good now. Shawn Michaels and Road Dogg and all those guys are, you know, they're doing the best they can to make that good. And I wasn't saying it that I was talking about the culture, you know, as part of something special with a yellow and gold brand. It's just not there anymore. And it was time to, you know, they can do whatever they want. It's their company. But I also have to make the decision for myself. You know, when I'm driving into Orlando every day and my stomach's in knots because I don't like to go to work, I have to make that choice, you know, and I did.
Thanks to our friends at Geico for supporting Talk is Jericho. If you own or rent your home, you know it can be hard work, but you know what's easy is bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy, and it's a good thing too because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you can save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. Well, let's go back to the beginning of your career, because you've never been on the show before. I want to talk about how you got into the WWE in the first place, because you've told me snippets of it that I remember, and it's one of those classic, just, we were all that way when there was no internet and there was no stooge sheets. It was just like, how can I get in the WWE? Maybe I'll try it this way. So kind of explain what your first foray is into trying to get booked, brother, were.
Yeah. So I the first wrestling ring I was ever in was a WWF ring. My buddies and I used to go to the shows early to try to meet the guys, you know, and get pictures with them and wait outside the arenas. We get there, you know, 12 hours before, the trucks wouldn't even be there yet. You know, it's just a house show somewhere.
Wearing tighter shirts.
And I was probably 15 years old. We were at a show, I think it was Biddeford, Maine. And it was like a C show, not even a B show. I mean, I think the main event was the Rockers. And it was like the Rockers had just come in. I think they were still using the Midnight Rockers versus the Conquistadors was the main event, right?
And that's got to be a high school gym show.
Right.
Pretty close, right?
Yeah, it was really. And then, so we're standing in line at the concession stands, and this dude gets in line behind us, and he has a WWF ring crew shirt on, polo shirt. So we start talking to him. We start talking to this guy, and, you know, he works on the ring crew, shoots the shit, whatever. And then a few weeks later, I don't know if you remember this or not, but Bret Hart and Bad News were starting a program, and Bad News had a match on like Superstars. And then as he's getting out of the ring, there's this fan in the front row with the Bret Hart plastic glasses on, and Bret and Bad News goes out there and rips them off his head and rips them up. That's the dude that we were talking to. Oh. They used him as a plant, right?
Oh.
So the next time they come to Portland, Maine, which was where I grew up going to all the shows, we, again, we go early. He's the guy. We start talking to him again. He remembers us. He starts over time. He starts letting us set up the ring with him. And he would go, all right, guys, I'm going to go get some lunch. I didn't say you could get in the ring, but wink, wink. And then we would get in there and just mess around until I can remember Arnold Skolin throwing us out one time, you know, showing up to the building and here we are, 15 years old, jumping around. He throws us out. And, another time was Jimmy Miranda, who was the merchandise guy, who eventually went to Pat Patterson for me and said, hey, why don't you give this kid a look? You know, and got me a tryout. Really? So Jimmy Miranda throws me out of the ring, and then years later, gets me a tryout. So,
didn't you call WWE headquarters a couple times or something like that too?
I did. I wrote a letter to them asking when I was like, same thing, right around the same time, 14, 15 years old. I wrote a letter and asked, what wrestling school do you guys take your wrestlers from? And I didn't think I'd ever hear back, you know, and I got the address. I think it was like out of the back of the WWF magazine, somewhere in the magazine. And I got a letter back from Sue Aitchison.
No kidding.
Still with the company.
She's the best. She has run awesome. Everything backstage from Make-A-Wishes to WrestleMania parties to apparently writing letters to kids.
Yeah. So she wrote me back and just said there wasn't any specific school. And I still have the letter, and they ended up publishing the letter in the WWF magazine years later.
Oh, that's cool. But that's so cool.
Yeah. Pretty cool. But so from there, there was a guy who was at one of these WWF house shows looking at the ring because he had just bought an old boxing ring. He said it was Rocky Marciano's boxing ring. He was trying to convert it to a wrestling ring. And he said, oh, I'm going to be doing a show, you know, coming up. So he booked us on the first show I ever wrestled on was his half wrestling, half boxing show. and it was Thanksgiving night, November of 89.
Wow. You started before I did.
Really?
Yeah. A year earlier.
It was head to head with the Survivor Series because at the time Survivor Series was on Thanksgiving night, right? So brilliant promoting move. I think we talked about it because the guys that I was wrestling with at the time, we had talked to the Harts and we had talked to Helen, and we were all set to come out there right around that time. And Helen told us, "Don't come." She said, "It's not even the Harts running it anymore," something like that. Well, so we didn't end up going. I can't remember the exact details, but we didn't end up going.
That's about the time frame, because Stampede ended in about middle of 89. Like you said, by the time Thanksgiving 89 came around, there was no more Stampede anymore.
Crazy.
So how did you first get into the WWE and start working? Because I remember you started like in the light heavyweight division or something along those lines.
Yeah, but even before that, I had met Phil Apollo, who was fabulous. Phil Apollo, and we're like world class. He was a manager. Not people confuse him with Ray Apollo, who became
different guy. Doink. Yeah.
But this was Phil Apollo, Playboy Phil Apollo, Playboy Vince Apollo. And he saw me in an indie show. And then one day I'm working, I'm like, again, like a teenager. And summer of 91, I'm working at a Kentucky Fried Chicken. And they say, you have a phone call, right? So what the heck? And it's just Phil Apollo. I told him I worked at a Kentucky Fried Chicken. And he called all these different Kentucky Fried Chickens trying to find me and said he had been doing extra work.
Oh, that's great.
For WWF. And he said, they want me to bring another guy. So I went up in August of 91 and had my first. I was still in high school. Just turned 18 in August. My birthday was in July. This was like August 19th, and I wrestled the Beverly Brothers.
That's unbelievable. Because you're talking about 91, because it wasn't until about 98 or so when the light heavyweight division started. So yeah. All those years you were doing extra work there?
Yeah, I signed in February of 97 when they started that first light heavyweight tournament, the tournament there. But yeah, so I did extra work. I ended up going to Memphis to work for USWA in 93 for a couple months, came back, did more extra work. And I was actually working live events, house shows as an extra. I would be like the go-to guy in the Northeast if somebody missed their flight or, you know, because there wasn't a developmental system at the time. So they would just find somebody local. And I was their guy up in that area.
The guy we always had in the Winnipeg area was Scott McGee.
Yeah, I remember the name. Yeah.
Every time you saw Scott McGee, you'd be like, oh, I know he's going to lose, but I hope this time he wins.
Yeah.
So you were just kind of keeping yourself busy on the indie scene then. So then what finally was the catalyst to get you signed to WWE?
It was Taz. It was either Taz or Dreamer got me booked for a tryout, 2 days of tryouts with ECW. Then they were going to be in Massachusetts. On Friday and Saturday, but on Thursday, WWF was going to tape Raw. I have a hard time saying WWE when I'm talking about this time.
I know.
It's okay. Weird, right?
We know what it is. You say what you want.
Yeah. And so WWF was going to be taping Raw because they were going into the Christmas break on Thursday. So I go, I'll leave a day early. I'll stop into Raw and I'll just try to talk to Bruce Pritchard and say, you know, maybe just kind of push him. Let's go, hey, I'm going to work for ECW the next couple of days. You know?
Hey.
And so I saw him and he was in a hurry when I ran into him. And he said, I can't talk right now. He said, but can you call me on Wednesday? So I said, yeah, sure. So I go and I do Friday, Saturday work. I work Taz for ECW for TV taping. And the very first night, Taz and Dreamer brought me into a room. I said, we want to do something with you. And then I said, can I let you know next week? Bruce Pritchard wants to talk to me on Wednesday. So I called Bruce on Wednesday and he said, yeah, we'd like to offer you we're starting his light heavyweight division and we'd like to give you a contract, you know. So
you finally got it.
Got it. Yeah.
How was that light heavyweight division?
I always joke and say, you know, we've changed the term over the years from like jobber to local to extra. I always go, now it's light heavyweight division. Dude, you know who I was eliminated from that tournament by?
Who?
Kane.
Why was Kane in the...
So I won my first round match. I went to the second round match, which was supposed to be against Brian Christopher. But this is when Kane had just come in, and he was just coming out, choke slamming, tombstone guys, right? So they send me to the ring. I'm waiting for Brian to come out. And they hear, you know, Kane's music hits, comes down. Same thing, choke slam, tombstone. I'm out of the tournament. Like Brian just advances.
It's totally legal. Yeah. Why wouldn't it be? Which is funny because didn't you and Kane end up riding together for years and years?
For years, yeah. Such a great dude, man. And it was cool at the time because, you know, we could travel together and nobody really knew who we were because, you know, without my hair spiked, you know,
right.
8 inches in the air and with him without the mask on, you know, they thought they were probably wrestlers, but they didn't know who we were, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, because you mentioned like the late 90s, the WWE was trying to, Yes, in their own kind of quaint way. We know what WWE is all about, WWF. It's about big guys, but they were trying to kind of, you know, keep the trend and the fashion and being kind of current and having a light tournament, heavier tournament, because that was the time when WCW, you know, the cruiserweights and ECW was going. But they really didn't do too much with it or really know what to do with it.
No, they never have. You know, even when they try to bring back 205, you know, this last the last version of it, it's the same thing over and over. And I would tell those guys, dude, I used to be you guys. I get it. Just go out there and just hang out there, hang in there and kill it and do your thing.
Talk is Jericho is supported by Indeed. Hiring talent for any business can be a challenge. If you want an all-star team, then you need an all-star hiring partner. You need Indeed.com/Jericho. Don't struggle on your own to find quality candidates. Indeed can help you hire the right people right now. Indeed is a hiring partner that gets you what you really want, a short list of quality candidates as fast as possible, because with Indeed, you can do it all. You can attract, interview, hire all in one place. Indeed partners with you on every step of the hiring process so you can find talent with the skills you need through tools like Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. With Instant Match, as soon as you sponsor a post, you get a short list of quality candidates whose resume on Indeed match your job description, and you can even invite them to apply right away. Get started right now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/Jericho. Get a $75 credit at Indeed.com/Jericho. Indeed.com/Jericho. Offer valid through December 31st. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? Then you need Indeed.com/Jericho. So how did you end up going into the two cool Scotty Too Hotty era?
Well, before that was too much. It was
okay, right.
So I was sitting home on a Wednesday. I hadn't worked for months. I'm ready to get released any day. You know, just waiting for that phone call because they're not using me. And they call me on Wednesday. WrestleMania is going to be in Boston. So this must have been like WrestleMania 14 is going to be in Boston on Sunday. And they said, hey, we need you for WrestleMania on Sunday, but we need you. We also have a show on Friday outside at, was it Faneuil Hall or City Hall? And this was the deal. I don't know if you remember, it was outside and they had Tyson and DX and it was crazy amount of people just on this outside. Like they called it the DX workout or something like that. But so they brought me in for that. I wrestled Taka Michinoku. And then on Sunday I was in this tag team battle royal, just thrown in there. Brian Christopher and I, and, that day, the day of WrestleMania, I go to catering to get a coffee. And the way I remember it, and this might not be how it really happened, but you know, you remember things a certain way is I go to get a coffee and it's like there's nobody else, you know, for a mile around. And as I'm getting the coffee, here comes Vince McMahon, you know, and he's getting the coffee and there's like a spotlight shining down on us, you know. And I said, hey, thanks for having me, you know, putting on WrestleMania. It's really cool. And I said, I know you have me with Brian Christopher, who's, you know, too sexy Brian Christopher at the same time. And just within a couple years before that, I had used the name Scott Too Hot Taylor on some indie shows. So, and I pitched that to him. And then next week I was Scott Too Hot Taylor. He was too sexy Brian Christopher, and together we were too much. Yeah. And we were like the, you know, ambiguous gay duo. That was kind of the thing, right? But then, you know, I can remember we used to do the spots, you know, like Austin would love them, you know, and he'd be like, hey, you gonna do that spot tonight, you know, and we would do it. But then we got to a point, and this was the first time I ever met Stephanie. I think she was like 18. We're at TV somewhere, and she's just hanging out with Vince for the day. And he comes up to us, and dude, I barely had a conversation with him. Since the coffee,
WrestleMania. Coffee incident, yeah.
And he said, you know, we've seen tag teams come and go over the years. He goes, but we've never seen tag teams come together, you know, for life. And he goes, I want to do a wedding where you guys marry each other on Monday Night Raw. And we'll have, you know, we'll have all the other guys on the outside in their tuxedos and clapping. And I'm like, oh, my God. So I'm like, I don't know, 23, somewhere in early 20s. And I'm like, man, I'm thinking, okay, he had just become the heel promoter with the whole Bret Hart thing. So in my mind, I'm trying to justify all this. Like, okay, I could do this. And then a year from the, down the road, you know, we could say, oh, the heel promoter made us do this. And, you know, we come out baby faces. You know, I'm trying to justify every idea in my own head. And Brian just wouldn't do it. You know, he had wrestled for his dad in Memphis for years and years and had a solid paycheck there. So I'm sure he had a backup, you know, to go, if he had to go back there. So he flat out refused to do the tag team wedding, and which Billy and Chuck later did, right?
Oh, and, wow. Yeah. Interesting. Right? Yeah. Oh, he wanted you guys to do that. Yeah. Okay, I got it. Wow. Yeah.
So, so from there.
Would you have done it?
I mean, yeah. At the time, right, you know, right. And now, I don't know, you know, but now we'd be baby faces, though.
yeah, exactly. You'd be pushed as baby faces.
Right. And we said no. So they took us, and Ronnie and Donnie Harris were coming out as DOA with the motorcycles. And they took us, and they made us like their bitches, and they put us on the back of their bikes with pink with pink motorcycle helmets on, and we would just come out holding their waists, you know, like we're going to bike week.
God.
We're headed to bike week with these two giant bald dudes, right? And
oh my goodness!
And so I don't know if that was our punishment, that was our test. You know, I just thought about this the other day. I go, was that just a test for the too cool thing? Like, oh, we've got this cool thing, but let's see if they're really on board and we'll test them a little bit. You know, you never know with them.
I go a little bit of punishment too. It's like, all right, let's make them side men. Yeah. You know,
So, you know, then in what it must have been May of 99, I think, we did a pre-tape, a backstage pre-tape saying that Too Much was dead. You know, we're now known as Too Cool. And that, dude, the promo, and now I go back and watch it, is so cringy. Just like I can remember Brian and I sitting in a locker, and the locker room writing this promo at ourselves. Like, oh, it's horrible.
Because this is pre-writers, too.
Right. Yeah. There might have been one writer at the time, you know, maybe. But not for us, though.
So, what did you say? What was cringy?
Oh, it's just like, we're the coolest cats in the litter box. And just that, you know, we're talking like little, you know, white boy wannabe rappers, you know.
And that was the gimmick.
That was what it was when it started. I think over time it evolved into just kind of like this fun thing, you know, but at first that's what it was, you know. And then like the very next day, so we did that aired on Sunday Night Heat. The very next day we had a house show in Portland, Maine, of all places. And Brian tears his ACL. We're wrestling Mark Henry and D'Lo Brown.
No.
Brian tears his ACL. We're out for like 6 months. I think we came back in October. But in the meantime, they had me on some live events, you know, and then we came back in October to Monday Night Raw. I think we jumped somehow. It was involving Matt, Jeff, Edge and Christian, mm-hmm. and the Hollies. We all, the four teams ended up going to Survivor Series that year. I know. And then December, they said, hey, we're going to put Rikishi with you. You know, he's got this thong on. He's going to come out, save you guys. And then we want you guys to put together some kind of like victory dance. And I'm like, dude, like I have one dance move, and that's the worm, and that's all I've got. To this day, I've never danced as myself in public. It's just all gimmick stuff.
Why did you know how to do the worm by chance?
Because I did break dance in elementary school. You know, that's when like break in and break into Electric Boogaloo stuff, you know. So we would bring the cardboard out to recess, and we would do the backspin and all that stuff. So that's all I could do, the backspin and the worm and the moonwalk, you know. And I incorporated all that stuff into the character, but that's all I had. People to this day will still write to me and they go, oh, you know, I learned to dance because of you, and you're such a good dancer. And I was like, I was making fun of the drunk white guy in the club. Right. I thought he could dance, you know.
But the difference was you played it straight and Kishi could dance.
Yes.
That's another reason why that worked, because you had this big freaking, what is he, 340, 340 pound Samoan who could move.
Yeah.
And then put them with you two guys. It just worked.
It was magic. Dude, the very first night we did it, it was like, this is what the reaction was. Just we knew we had something, you know. And it was crazy because at the time, the three of us were kind of on the chopping block. You know, none of us had really done anything. He hadn't done anything for a while. I think he had been in Memphis with the character, with
Well, and there really wasn't a character. He was supposed to be kind of the blonde sumo wrestler, but then they kind of made him kind of the street guy. I remember it was Fat, like PHAT was his streetwear, and it just really wasn't clicking at all. At first.
And the Sultan was in there somewhere.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. And then he was in Memphis. I think he was wearing the thong in Memphis or the trunks in Memphis or something.
Yeah.
And it just all worked. And Brian put together that victory dance, which became, you know, the Too Cool Rikishi dance. He put that together. And then, and then I had the Worm and Rikishi had the Stink Face, and we all kind of had our thing, you know. And I think Rikishi also gave us a little bit of credibility as far as being able to do a little bit more in the ring rather than just the character stuff.
You weren't too goofs anymore. You had this killer guy in there who everything he did just looked amazing.
Right. Right.
You know, it's interesting because, first of all, I coined the term stink face, by the way.
Really?
I gave that to him, yeah. But the other thing is, at that point in time, if you're talking about, like, you know, 99, like when I first got into WWE, which is around this time frame, everybody was over.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
I remember you guys were like the perennial opening match. It was Godfather first. Yep. And then you guys, or maybe just you, Godfather was the first wave. And then when he was done, you guys were the second wave of being opening match, which, by the way, is the most important match with the exception of the main event, because you got to kick it off right. And you guys would tear the house down every single night opening up the show.
Yeah, it was crazy, right? Sometimes I forget how crazy that time was. And I go back and I'll see some old stuff. And dude, the signs and the crowds were just
remember that?
Yes.
Everybody had a sign.
Yep. I mean, I joke now that there used to be more people at the loading docks watching us come and go from the arena than there are in the arenas now. I don't know how far off that is. But dude, it was like we were rock stars. And you know, you hate to say that. I mean, you are, but I mean, like, you know. It was cool. I always said my career peaked at the peak of the coolest time in wrestling.
Yes.
You know,
the peak of the Attitude Era, if that's what we want to call it. Yeah. Let's talk quickly about Brian Christopher as a partner. I only worked with you guys a few times, and Brian was, you know, he was a very kind of obnoxious on the outside, a little arrogant. I'm not going to say not my type of guy, but I never really got to know him because we never really had any reason to interact. What was he like for you as a guy and as a partner?
It was stressful.
Yeah.
We were very different people. He kind of lived the character after a while, I think. I can remember like going to shows. This was after we left WWE. Like we were doing some shows in Memphis, and he would leave the show with his gear on. You know, we'd go to lunch, and here he is sitting in the Too Cool outfit. You know, and he was a wild man. And you know, I think he went down a bad road somewhere along the way because when I met him in '93 in USWA. He didn't drink, he didn't do drugs, he didn't do anything. He was clean. You know, he was still Brian, you know. Mm-hmm. Dude, I can remember I was at Channel 5 in Memphis and there's this long hallway, and here he comes, and I had seen him in the magazines and stuff. So I knew it was Lawler's kid, you know, and I see him coming towards me and I'm walking towards him and he completely no-sold me. Didn't even acknowledge that I was there. And I was like, oh, this guy's a dick, you know. But dude, there was something special when we got in that ring that you couldn't even really explain it. But as far as like, we never rode together. We never roomed together. We did room together. I thought about that. We roomed together at, and this is where I met you for the first time, was at Owen's funeral.
Oh, wow.
Because they doubled guys up in rooms because the company paid for whoever wanted to go.
Right.
And you were just getting ready to come in.
Yeah.
I think you were in between the two companies, right?
And it was May of 96. I started in August. So
And
99. My apologies. 99.
And because I always thought it was the coolest thing. Like if there was anything good about the whole situation was because there was a real war going on at the time with, you know, WCW, WWF, and even ECW was factored in to a degree at the time. And at the funeral, on each side of me was you and then Shane Douglas when it was on the outside. And look around that room and I was like, wow, like he brought together all these people in this room. Like it probably never done again. you know?
I have a picture with about 10 world champions in it at Owen's funeral. Yeah. Exactly like you said, the Funks were in there, and Douglas and Jericho and Benoit and Brett. And, you know, you name it, from all the Harley Race, all eras and all territories were there, you know?
Yeah, crazy, man. Crazy. Yeah. Yeah. But Brian was just a wild man, you know? And I knew, like, you know, he had been arrested multiple times leading up to his death. And I can remember whenever he would get arrested, he knew his mugshot was going to get publicity, especially in Memphis, right? So he'd always be smiling or laughing in his mugshot. Yeah, yeah, Brian being Brian, he was a worker 24/7, right?
Right. And, so carny.
Yep. And in that last mugshot I saw him, he wasn't smiling. He looked like he was 60 years old. He just looked worn the fuck out. And and then shortly, that was when he died. And, he died in jail. Yeah. A few days later, you know.
Which is a terrible thing, especially with the heights that you guys got to. And you were, like we said, we talk about you as opening match amazing, but you guys got to some pretty big main events too. Why don't you talk about some of those?
Yeah. I mean, people always ask me, like, what was my, you know, biggest match or favorite match? And it was probably, I always say it was Monday Night Raw. It was like February of 2000. It was Rikishi, Too Cool, Cactus Jack, and The Rock against DX and the Radicals. So it was Hunter, X-Pac, Perry, Dean, Benoit, with Eddie on the outside, with Stephanie on the outside, with Tori on the outside, with New Age Outlaws doing a run-in, Kane doing a run-in, Paul Bearer coming with Kane. You know, dude, like,
let me just say, I was so jealous of that match because I wasn't anywhere near it, and everybody was on it. I remember Monday Night Raw, like, there was like single match, and then this giant match, and I was like, "Oh my god, we're in the match!" It was crazy. Huge. Yeah, it was amazing too.
Yeah, and you go back and watch it, and again, the crowd is just electric, and the crowd made it, because when we were putting that together, I can remember sitting there, all of us together in the locker room, putting this thing together, and being, "Oh, this is gonna be a cluster." There's just so much going on, and nobody was on the same page with each other when we went out there. And again, it was just magic when it happened, you know.
What made it magic? Like, how did you guys end up working it out?
I think it was just the crowd. Honestly, it was just the energy of, you know, and maybe, you know, just seeing us in there, you know, with The Rock and Cactus, and there was just all these different dynamics, and DX with the Radicals, and I don't know, it just all fell into place, but it was cool.
Let's talk about the worm for a bit, because you mentioned you did it as a dance. How did it start becoming a finishing move?
So in that, when I told you, I don't know if it was ever a finishing move.
One of your moves,
because people say, like, oh, that was a finish. I remember Vince said, we were doing like King of the Ring qualifying matches on like Raw and SmackDown, and I worked with D'Lo, and Vince had told whoever their producer was for my match, Vince said, use the worm. If Rock can use the people's elbow, you can use the worm as a finish. Yeah. So I remember beating D'Lo with it for that match, but most of the time I would hit it and just pop up and fire up because there was more to come, you know?
Yeah.
But it started with, actually, when we were with DOA, I used to just do it on the entrance. We would get in the ring and I would just drop down and start doing the worm just to pop those guys.
Yeah.
Or pop, you know, I remember we were working with like the Acolytes a lot of the time. I do it just to pop them. Just kind of a joke then, you know. And then while Brian was out with his torn ACL, I told you, like, I was working house shows, and I can remember, like, specifically working A-Train and laying him out by the ropes and then hitting the opposite ropes, stopping, dropping down and worming across, and like dropping an elbow or dropping a headbutt. I was doing different things, just playing with it. I knew I had something because of the reaction I was getting from the crowd just from the worm part. I just had to figure out what it was, you know. And then one night on Raw, I laid whoever it was out, and as I hopped to the other side, and as I was hopping, Jerry Lawler said W-O-R-M. So the next day I heard that, you know, they used to play the show in catering.
Yeah.
You know, the next day, and I heard him do that. And so I went up to him and said, hey, you think you could keep doing that? Because I think it would catch on with the crowd. And sure enough, you know, he did it. And then at the end, you know, it was like W-O-R-M, worm, 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 who, who, who. The whole who was just me blown up going, but the crowd started doing it, you know? And the whole karate chop thing was, do you remember John Tatum?
Yeah, Hollywood John Tatum.
Yeah, he was a world-class guy. And I can remember he used to do this thing when he was introduced where he did like this martial arts thing.
Yeah,
so that's where the
martial artist guy.
Yeah, that's where the whole karate chop dropped down into the throat chop at the end of the worm came from. So it was just, dude, like I would tell the wrestlers at the PCL that just throw shit against the wall because you do not know what's going to work. If I had sat down, wrote that whole thing out and presented it to somebody, they would have said, this is horseshit. Don't ever do that. You know, but sometimes you just got to try. You just have to try stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, like for me, I always love that. I love the People's Elbow. I love the Worm. I love John Cena's You Can't See Me because it's so bad.
That's it, right?
It gets the reaction. And who would not rather take that than a German suplex or anything? Like, just give me this. I'll just lie here and you hit me with some dumb thing. But there were some guys in the locker room who were very adamant they were not going to take the Worm. Do you remember those guys?
Yeah. And I would always like, if they ever said, don't leave me laying there too long, that's a signal to leave him laying there too long. Dude, I'm going to let you throw me around. Like, you're not going to throw me around unless I let you.
Just sell.
I'll just lay there. Nobody's watching you anyways. You know, I can remember working with Dean Malenko on house shows, and I would hit him with a bulldog and I would be standing over him getting ready to run in place, and I'd look down and he'd be laying there pretending he's smoking a cigarette. And you know Dean, so you know that's true, right?
Because
he knows like nobody's watching him at that moment, right? It's just like watching
this
crazy thing about to happen, you know. Yeah, but dude, it was such a great time. I'm so thankful, and even where I'm at right now, like I'm so thankful for everything that came out of my time there, and so appreciative. And even my feelings right now, just, you know, I was a little burnt out coming out of there, and but I'll always be thankful. And dude, if it wasn't for that place, I wouldn't have had the platform to do all the cool things I've done, you know? So.
And not to mention like you were a big, let me rephrase that. Austin and Rock were a big part of the Attitude Era, but you were a part of the Attitude Era and an integral one. You had a lot of steam in that time frame, so you contributed in a big way, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that's pretty cool, because once again, I really find, and dude, like I said, I worked for Vince for 20 years. I loved it. I don't understand sometimes the new way of getting guys over when the old way was great. Everybody was over, man, you know.
I know. And that was I started to say it earlier, like with the new rules coming in, was now you know, if you're getting punched, they want you trying to block punches, and no bumping feet. Or if you're going to bump and feed, you have to be on a comeback. You have to look like you're going to do something as you're coming up, and no double feed in a tag match. And I'm like, dude, like this is all the stuff that made wrestling fun for me.
Right.
I need to either make a decision. Okay, I'm going to jump on board with this and teach the way that I don't agree with, or I walk away.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I chose to do. But
let's talk about some of your famous dance routines, because I remember there's a great one that when China and I were ill-fatedly together, we did one with you guys in Madison Square Garden. You could put the shades on, and that was kind of the hypnotizing where everyone just does the thing. Was there some of those that stand out for you?
Always with you. You know, I know we did it with you a bunch, right?
Yeah.
But it was, you know, China, Eddie, Rob Van Dam was the worst dancer of all time. Tajiri probably did the best Worm of all time. I think he could do it like backwards or something, but and that was a cool part of that whole thing, was seeing these guys dance who you wouldn't expect to dance, you know. And the Dudleys just going full on out with the dancer, Big Show doing the Worm, and you know, and we would do that almost every night, because like you said, Brian and I would open the show, we'll be on the first half of the show, and then Rikishi would be in the main event. You know, we would, you know, DX or whoever would get involved, start beating Here We Come, you know, bump the heels out, and then we would dance with whoever we were out there with, you know. And when like you said, we did it multiple times on TV with the Hardys and you, and such a fun is the only word, right? Like, it was just fun stuff. Yeah, and I think that's what the whole Attitude Era was fun.
Yeah, the crowd was so involved in everybody's act. You know, like I mentioned before, like whether it was the Godfather all the way up to Steve or the Rock or whoever it was, everybody had a slot and people knew, okay, here's where they're going to do a Worm. Here's where they're going to say, ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages. Here's where they're going to chant Y2J. Here, whatever it may be, there was something going on at all times.
Yeah. It was a KISS concert, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I just went to see KISS recently, and I was like, man, they're more pro wrestling now than pro wrestling is pro wrestling.
You know? That's true. Did Rikishi ever turn on you guys when he turned heel? I can't remember what happened.
He did. Because remember, he ended up being the driver of the car that ran over Austin. And that just killed all of the... It killed all the steam, you know. They didn't have I don't think they had a plan for us. And then I think once Austin beat him, I don't know if they really had a plan for him.
You know? How far can you go, right?
Yeah. So I felt like we had more time left. We were that year, 2000, Jimmy Miranda, who was the merchandise guy, told me at the time that we were second in merchandise behind The Rock. The Rock was the only one. You know, so.
And that's not something you were supposed to know.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. How did it, as we start to wind down, how did you end up teaming up with Albert?
That was our pitch. You know, we'd been friends. I met him before he ever even had his first match. And we pitched it more of, we wanted to be, I was the goofball that I was, the Scotty Giotti character, and he was the guy that he was, more of the serious heavy, you know, and I could get us into trouble, then he would have to, defend us. And the first night they put us together, they said, all right, you guys are going to dance afterwards together. And I was like, oh, this is going to be all, you know, this is like we're trying to recreate something that's already been done. So we waited outside of Vince's office, waited. We finally go in there, and we still joke about this. He said to Vince, I just don't want to be a second-rate Rikishi. And Vince looked at him like we just ran over his cat and said, second-rate Rikishi. Like, you know, and then but he's so smart, dude. Then he goes, Scotty Too Hottie, people pay to see Scotty. People buy tickets to see. So, like, he puts me over, you know, and after he just insulted him, you know. So I'm like, yeah, just dance.
He makes money. You don't. You're dancing.
You know, people joke about going in to talk with him, and you don't get it unless he's such an intimidating guy. You know,
he is an evil Jedi. He will make you think things you don't want to think and do things you don't want to do. And you'll walk out of the office going, what the hell did I just agree to? Hey, let me back in. And what was the name of you guys at the time? There was some dumb name.
We were the Zoo Crew. I don't know if they ever officially used that, but this is what we're calling ourselves, because he was the hip hop hippo and I was the worm. I was like, oh, it was
the Zoo Crew. Right?
It's fun to look back on and laugh, but man.
Yeah. So what was the final straw for you when you finally got let go, I guess, or the first time?
I think it was just all getting let go.
In 2007?
The first time?
Is that what it was? Yeah.
Yeah. It just, it was like they didn't have anything for me. You know, they didn't have anything for me. I was, like I said, I was working with the new flavor of the week, whoever that was, and just, you know, some unsafe guys. And they put me out on the road with some of these guys. And then I go, man, this guy's awful. And then, you know, they would start him at TV, and then they would go, oh, wow, this guy's awful. And they pull him off. And then if you just asked me, I could have told you that, you know, but, you know, and then I had a back injury, a low back injury. And I was out for a few months just rehabbing and stuff. And then the day I got cleared, I got a call later in the afternoon from John Laurinaitis and said, it's so weird. Like, I remember him saying, how's the weather down there? You know, I'd be like, oh, it's great. You know, like, it's raining up here, you know? And he said, just kind of let you know, we're going to release you, let you go however you were. And I'm like, why do we have to talk about the weather first?
Exactly. On my very first cruise that I did, my idea was to have NXT involved. This was pre huge NXT. Yeah. And it took them 3 months to decide. And they put me on a 45-minute call where they talked about all this stuff, and they said, well, and so blah, 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 10 minutes, blah, 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 blah. And the bottom line is we're going to pass. I'm like, thanks, you could have done that in a minute. See you later. Right. And I had Ring of Honor on the phone, and 3 minutes later. I was like, awesome. You don't have to give me 45 minutes of small talk. Just say we're not interested. See you later.
Exactly, right. So funny.
Is it hard to walk away from WWE? And obviously, you mentioned that you want to be happy, and I totally get that. But deep down inside, is it still hard? Because it is kind of the Stockholm syndrome. You must be here to succeed sometimes.
Yeah, no, I realized that the first time. Well, when I got released, I went out and I worked indies for almost 10 years, you know, doing cons and appearances and indies. And I always say it was probably the most enjoyable time in my career just because I was my own boss. Yes, some of the shows are horrible, you know, but you got to take it all with a grain of salt. Some of them are great. You know, some of them are pretty close to backyard, but you know, right, the money is there. You're having fun. You know, if it's a bad show, it's only going to last for a few hours and then something good's going to come out of it.
Right.
Meet somebody cool, whatever. And then, so when anybody, after that happened to me, whenever anybody that I was close with would get released, I would text them and say, or call them and say, there's life after WWE. You know, so I knew that coming in this time. And like I said before, honestly, from day one, when I came back as a coach, a goal was to walk away on my own. You know, and it just felt like the time was right. And I'll tell you a story, dude. Like one of the final things, one of the final straws, there were a bunch of things leading up to it. And I knew it was time. But my girlfriend and I went to Puerto Rico a few weeks ago. And I was I texted Ruby Riot, Ruby Soho, this story. I want her to know this. But I was sitting on a plane in San Juan waiting to fly back. And the video popped up from AEW in Indianapolis. I think it was Punk and Cody and maybe Tony Khan in the ring. And it looked like it was after the show went off the air.
Her
hometown, right? And they call her out. And you can tell it was all just done on the fly. And dude, I was literally sitting on the plane with tears rolling down my face being like, that's how it's supposed to be. Right? Like that was a genuine moment that like, it wasn't about money. It was about giving her a moment in her hometown, a feel-good moment for her, an appreciation moment for her, a feel-good moment for that audience and family and friends in that crowd. You know, people can call you a mark or whatever they want to call you all day long, but we bust our asses many, many, many days away from these people. When you're in a situation like that, like, give it to them. Let them have the moment. You know what I mean? Dude, I was in Portland, Maine, the same building I told you the story about where I would set up the ring and had a match. All of my family, I have 20 people in the front row. My baby daughter, Taylor, is in the front row. You know, my mom, my dad, grandparents, aunts, uncles, you know, all these people sitting in the front row and I wrestle Sylvain Grenier. And nothing against Sly, but this was late. This was after like tag team champion Sly even, you know, and not that that even matters, but, and they beat me.
Yeah.
They beat me. I'm the one guy at the time. I was the only guy to ever make it to the WWF from the state of Maine. Now there's been Fandango, but I was the only guy. We had the only two guys. I was the only guy. And we're in, you know, here we are in Portland, Maine, and not only my hometown, but my home state. And we got to beat you on a live event just as a little.
On a live event, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
I could never understand that, man. You know what I mean?
And they do that a lot, you know.
We go to, you know, Long Island, and it turns MJF babyface because we know what's going to. And we're celebrating everybody that comes from this area.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah. Well, so what's your goal now as you kind of get back on the horse of being a wrestler again?
Honestly, it's just to have fun. Have fun and travel again. You know, that was another thing. There aren't any NXT live events right now, you know, and I don't know if there will be again from the sounds of it. Hopefully there are for those people involved. But that was my wheelhouse. I was the main roadshow NXT producer.
Gotcha.
You know, that was my thing. Like I was a solid TV producer, I think. I was a solid coach, but producing those live events out on the road was my biggest strength.
Especially,
And I enjoy traveling, man. Like I miss that. It's in me, and I like, you know, that lifestyle. I'm pretty booked, pretty solid up through April now.
That's great. Are you doing stuff with Rikishi as well?
Yeah, actually, we just had lunch yesterday. It was the first time I'd seen him in like 5 or 6 years, probably. But he was in Orlando. We sat down. We're going to try to do some stuff together.
That's a no-brainer.
That's it, man. And just have fun. You know, we have different definitely going over to Europe in March for a few shows.
That's great.
Yeah, and I thought I was done, you know, but then I see you guys still going and do it. And I don't have a style that I can't deliver. If I ever get to a point where I go, man, I got to wear a shirt and I'm phoning it in, I won't do it. But right now I'm in great shape, dude. I do hot yoga at night. I do bodyweight workouts at the gym in the morning and I push it hard and I know I can still go and deliver. So it's just out, get out there and have some fun, you know, and go all the places that I can again. And
what name can you use?
Well, I feel like I can use Scotty anyways, right? Like I've been Scotty since I was born. So,
right. You Scotty.
You know, I've thrown around some different ideas like S2H maybe, you know, so
works.
The thing is now, like, and this is part of the exciting part, the fans are so smart. Whatever I end up using, you know, with social media, it's given everybody the platform to promote themselves. You know
it's like, you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like back in the day, you know, Hogan leaves. He can't be, you know, Terry.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Like all you do is you change your name on social media. You do some videos, you promote yourself well, and, you know, just be good to people. And I think you'll do all right. You know, that was another thing that played into my decision. I reached out to Matt Cardona and a few other guys and just like, hey, what do you think I can make on these shows? And the money's solid out there right now. And the indies are on fire, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and the Comic Cons are on fire and all these different vehicles that we didn't have in the past, whether, you know, even Cameo or Pro Wrestling Tees or all these different options that we
revenue
have.
Streams, yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm just looking to have fun. Yeah. So
last question for you. And you might have to think about it for a second. Do you have a favorite, like Too Cool Brian Christopher Rikishi story, a road story in the ring?
God, I don't know. The one I always go to is, you know, cause we would do the Magic Yellow Shades and we put them on. And sometimes I remember specifically doing this in Canada, I think it was like Calgary or Edmonton, and we would take black tape and Brian and I would tape the insides of the glasses. So because we put them the magic glasses on Rikishi, you can't take them off, you know, so we put them on him and he couldn't see. Yeah.
That's great. What would June Bug say after? Be mad
Yeah. He could get mad, but you know, he would have to do the dance basically blindfolded. So.
Well, dude, it's been great talking to you, man.
You and too, man.
Congratulations on following your heart, because the money and everything else always follows that second. So
absolutely,
it's going to be great. It's going to be great to see you somewhere down the road for sure.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much, Chris.
Awesome, man. Take care, brother.
Bye-bye.